Welcome to Hunger for Wholeness, a podcast from the Center for Christogenesis. I'm your host, Robert Nicastro. Today, Ilya speaks with theologian Matthew Fox. As this conversation took place during the midst of tragic violence in Israel and Palestine, Ilya asks Matt about the state of the world today and how to have courage and renewed spirituality in the face of war and climate crisis.
It's really wonderful to have you on our program, A Hunger for Wholeness. We at the Center for Christogenesis are, like you, deeply concerned for the fate of the earth and moving humanity to a new level of justice and unity, in a sense, creating a new humanity. And you have been involved in creation spirituality. You're a forerunner, really, in that area. Let me begin by asking you, what's your sense of the state of the world today, where we are, and has creation spirituality made a difference from your perspective, in how people are living in the world right now?
Well, I think we're at a real turning point. I think we're at a real crossroads. I think either humanity wakes up, grows up. I think we've been in an adolescent stage for a long time. And a good example is just the current news, of course, of what was going on in the Middle East. The whole idea of, giving Netanyahu $10 billion when the spiral of violence begins with poverty in the Palestinian areas. $10 billion for weapons and $100 million to alleviate the poverty, it doesn't make any sense to me. So we're still thinking in these old patriarchal and what I'd call reptilian brain ideas, action and reaction, instead of looking ahead and asking of our spiritual traditions, hey, what is humanity capable of? Why don't we start putting some money into that?
Right.
And I summarize it in one word, that we're capable of compassion, which means living out our interdependence, sharing joy and sharing suffering and not delivering more suffering. So to me, that's kind of where we're at. We're at this junction. Many people have spoken of this, but that's how I feel. And of course, the climate change is similar, isn't it? It's really staring us in the face. And we are facing our extinction, period. There's no question about it. And, I'm very taken by this information that science is coming up with. We keep discovering almost every month a new hominid, a distant ancestor. And we don't even have names for them all yet. They're tumbling in from Southeast Asia and everything. But the point is, they're all extinct. We're the only hominids standing. When are we going to wake up and face the music that we either have to choose our better selves or we're going to go their way? And things are not looking very promising.
No, I completely agree. In fact, I think in some ways the train has already left the station. In other words, I think we are already in evolution. I don't even think we're fully Homo sapien anymore. I think technology is rapidly changing us, even physiologically. So it's not just, a perceived change. It's an actual organic change. And I think we're mostly oblivious to this. So I think you're absolutely right. We still continue to act out of old static categories that are no longer relevant to the world. It's not so much we're creating. I do think science or someone's creating it. I feel sometimes we're losing our freedom to be active participants in this world, because I think it's money and power that really does, in a sense, shape the future direction of things. So I fully sympathize, with exactly what you're saying. And I would fully agree that patriarchy and power continue to have a grip on how politics is being shaped and acted out. And there's something about this, quite honestly, and I'd love to hear more from you. There's something about us that would rather stay in the mediocre center, even if it's going downhill, then taking a risk to move to the margins to see from a new direction. What's your take on that?
I couldn't agree more. For years, I've been saying the first sign of spirituality, if you will, is courage, that willingness to take a risk. And, we have to be teaching people that that's possible. And I'm often hunting and gathering for examples of courage, because, and one of the big awakenings to me about courage was when I visited the base communities in South America, especially in the Amazon. I spent a week or two with Bishop Casagala there, whose diocese is the Amazon. And he had a retreat going on that week for all the workers in the Amazon defending the rainforest and the indigenous people and the rest. And I went to their, they had a mass one night, a very simple mass in a gymnasium, about 400 of them. And at the end of the mass, the instruction was to go up and light a candle and name three people you knew personally who were tortured and put to death.
Well,
and everyone went up there. And one fellow afterwards told me the hard part was limiting it to three. He knew at least 10 off the top of his head. Now, these people were wearing jeans and t-shirts. They were ordinary people. And I learned from that how real courage is. If you really believe in certain values, and of course, the same thing shown in the civil rights movement, where you had teenagers filling the jails and all this and marching with dogs and fire hoses on them and all the rest. So humanity has more courage than we've ever been told. And where is it being taught? You know, who's teaching it? Who's modeling it? And so that's why I like to gather these stories of courage and adventure and risk-taking, because, as you say, I think as a species, we have to take some steps that are significant at this time.
Yeah.
As you say, mediocrity is not going to do it.
We have this solution that if we're financially secure and comfortable, we don't have to do much more because we're enjoying life. You know, the beach is great and skiing is wonderful. And I love my home and my family and my dogs. So why bother getting involved? But this is the thing I think you have written so much over the years. I think creation spirituality points to the deep interconnectedness, right? So, I mean, you can have one part of, you know, humanity and the earth suffering and the other part, you know, sitting by a bonfire roasting marshmallows as if nothing's happening in the world. We're in this together or we're not in it at all, I think. And that reality, and I fully agree, honestly, I find preaching, you know, from the pulpit kind of deadening most of the time. It's, you know, we're still on the Adam and Eve story and, you know, and Jesus doing good things for nice people. I think that's a great thing. But, you know, in the stories of Jesus need to be reinterpreted. This is a person who really pushed the margins. You know, he was a revolutionary. I mean, yes. He was not like a, you know, a homeboy that everyone loved. He was someone that they wanted to stone to death.
Exactly.
I think religion, I mean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but is religion a failure? You know, I think, you know, it does some good for us, certainly. You know, we have that comfort in the power of one we name as God or love or the beloved. But religion as an institution, and I think Pope Francis is trying to address this in some ways, but it's not only that it hasn't tried, it's really failing us. And so love to hear your ideas on that.
I think that's true. Unfortunately, there's potential there because there's Jesus and there's these people I was talking about, the Amazon. And I mean, there are a lot of people. There's Howard Thurman, and there's Dr. King, and there's Gandhi and others who have taken, Mandela too, have taken the teachings and really done something significant with them. And I think that that's what's missing. I think that, you know, I distinguish between spirituality and religion. I wish we didn't have that, make that distinction. But at this time in history, I think we do. And I think a lot of young people are throwing off religion as such, institutional religion, but are seeking for spirituality, one that speaks to the realities of our times, such as climate change and patriarchy and these other realities. And so I do think that religion is in a time of tremendous dying and maybe rebirth. I think all our institutions are. I think education is in as much trouble as religion is, I really do. I think the forms in which we're doing education, religion, politics, economics, all of it are modern, and we're living in this postmodern time. And this is where I think the wisdom of indigenous pre-modern peoples is especially rich for us today, and that includes when I talk about pre-modern people, I include the Middle Ages. I include St. Francis, your brother, and Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventure and others who lived, first of all, in a cosmos, not in a man-made world, not Descartes saying, I think, therefore I am, not this modern consciousness, which is what Pope Francis rightly calls the narcissism of our species. It just exploded in the modern era. And I mean, we're paying the bill on that. That's what climate change is all about. So pre-modern people, medieval and indigenous, they begin with the universe and they begin with gratitude for the universe. They know that somehow this is bigger than us and it's sacred. And hey, let's listen to it. And I think that's the big lesson to learn climate change, that we're guests. And it's taken 13.8 billion years to bring us here. And that's astounding. And it's awesome. And it should fill us with overflowing gratitude. And out of that comes a sense of reverence and, of course, the awe. And that's how you change people.
St. Francis of Assisi, his first prayer was, thank you. You know, waking up and say, thank you. You know, thank you for this life and the gift of the earth and the gift of all things. I couldn't agree more. I think that your emphasis on indigenous spirituality, in a sense, that cosmic order, like belonging to a whole, you know, so my experience of who I am is a part and parcel of my experience of the whole earth, the whole community with the sun and the stars. One of my students is from Africa, and he's writing on the concept of Ubuntu. I am because we are. And it's a beautifully rich concept of the interwovenness and the interconnectedness of all things. And I think the way Western modernity has parceled out, that kind of stripped this wholeness and like taking a hammer and chiseling it into little tiny little bits. And then you're one little bit trying to find your way, you know, in this big, big world. And it's frightening, you know, and therefore you have to keep accumulating stuff because, you know, you're just this little bit in a bunch of lot of little bits in the world. Instead of having this awareness that who I am is because who you are and because we are, there's a we before the I. And I think that kind of experience is now, it's really interesting. And I'm going to bring AI into this because I think technology, in some way, there's something deep in us that knows this modern reductionism to my little bit is really not what we're about. It's as artificial as it comes. And there's something about us that wants to get out of this hole that we find ourselves in. So,
without the W. Let me respond to you before you get into that other topic.
Yeah.
Because you brought up Africa. Several years ago, there was an Australian theologian lecturing in Africa, and he was being translated along the way. And, you know, with each sentence, he would stop and be translated. So he ended his talk this way. He said, the number one spiritual problem in Sydney today is loneliness.
Learn.
And the translator said, please repeat your sentence, which you did. And then the translator huddled with three or four other Africans. He came to the microphone and said, I'm sorry, sir. In our language, there is no word for loneliness. I just think that says it all. That, you know, I mean, we in the West know all about loneliness. We have a cosmic loneliness because we're not connected to the rest of nature, which befriends us when humans don't. And sometimes when humans do.
Even technologies championing global constant connectivity have not cured our feelings of loneliness, let alone climate and poverty crises. Liberation theology, while controversial, is one contemporary movement still trying to reconcile our theology with such 20th century crises and their legacy. Next, Ilya asks Matthew about his work on Marie-Dominique Chenu, a Dominican who has been credited alongside Gustavo Gutierrez as a forefather of liberation theology. Support for A Hunger for Wholeness comes from the Fetzer Institute. Fetzer supports a movement of organizations that are applying spiritual solutions to society's toughest problems. Please consider getting involved at Fetzer.org. Now, back to our conversation.
The other thing is your rich experience. Like, so far you've talked about the Amazon and Africa. I am just now becoming more and more struck how Western thinking has just imposed itself on the entire globe. Like, we just assume that, like, if we say we're lonely, that everyone's lonely around the world. But the fact is, there are cultures. And I'm just shocked that we haven't really, you know, reached out, bent low, say, hey, we need you, you know? Other cultures. We need your rich, you know, your insights, the way you live. We need to learn from you rather than, hey, you know, we're the U.S., we're smart and we're American and we're Western and we're modern.
We're running the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so well.
Let's tell you how to live. And
exactly.
Maybe climate change is going to do this for us because it's going to shift all the continents anyway, right? As the water levels rise, as the land masses start, you know, eroding, as they start shifting, I do think that parts of the U.S. could eventually wind up in China or Russia, or parts of Africa can wind up in New Jersey. And, you know, we're doing this because we're not even conscious of the effects of climate change. You know, this kind of Western thinking, we're alone, I consume, I buy till I drop dead, you know, type thing. And all the practices, the unhealthy practices, we have not only done for ourselves, but we insist that the rest of the world should do as well, you know, which is killing the planet. And therefore, the very thing that gives us life, which is relationship, right? It's deep connectivity. That's what life is about, connectivity. And we're learning that from the bottom up, right? From the very stuff of matter itself, from God, who is Trinity, you know, from a relational God. To relational matter, to relational people. So I really love actually all the work you have done over the years. What is your current thinking? I mean, like, what are you thinking about today and the next steps of where to go?
Well, one project I'm involved in is I'm writing a book. It's turned out to be a much bigger project than I thought, a bigger book. But on my mentor, Pierre Chenu, C-H-E-N-U, who was a French Dominican, I studied with him the very last he taught. He was 76 at the time. And he is the father, not only of Grace spirituality, but of liberation theology. And I think I'm proving he was the father of Vatican II as well. He wrote a book in 1937 on reinventing theological education because he was head of the Sossoir, which is the French Dominican School of Theology. And he wrote the book in 1937. But in 1942, it was put in the index by the Vatican. So he's up there with Voltaire and Karl Marx and every other important thing here in the history of Europe. Of course, he lost the job immediately. He was booted from his job and so forth. And then in the 1950s, he supported the worker priest movement after the war. And for that, he was exiled for 8 years. He was teaching in 3 different universities in Paris. He had to leave Paris. He was not allowed back into Paris for 8 years. He had to leave his community, etc. So he really went through that. And the 8th year was 1962, the year that Vatican Council began. And he attended the council not because a European bishop had the courage to invite him, but it was an African bishop who brought him to the council as his advisor. And it was a former student of Chenu. So that's interesting, too, that it was Africans, it was the so-called third world that allowed him into Vatican II. And he was very influential there. And, of course, one of his students was Yves Congar, who was very influential in Vatican II. He was a Dominican historian. And also Father Skilipix was a student, etc. So, and Mustafa Gutierrez, the father of liberation theology, he gave a talk 3 years ago in Tübingen, entitled Liberation Theology, the Daughter, Pierre Chenu. So this is what I'm working on. I'm working on this book. And I'm very excited about learning so much more about him. I knew he was special, and it was a special occasion to study with him in 1968, and as it turned out, his very last teaching job.
I do remember actually reading a book by Chenu, and I was struck by the way he spoke about the microcosm and the macrocosm. I think he likened it to like a musical harmony. Like, I think he used the term an immense zither.
Yes. And that's his book, Nature, Man, and Society in the 12th Century. And he says the 12th century was the greatest renaissance of the West because it was grassroots and not top-down like the 16th century. And just, that's the book. And all that is in there.
Wonderful book. Yeah.
He had an amazing view of the world, an amazing soul. And he was a very joyful man. Even though he went through all these horrors with the church, he didn't harbor anger or hostility or resentment or bitterness or anything. He was just always moving forward. And he wrote a lot about what we were talking about the need for courage. He said there is no theology without courage and risk and adventure. And he said there's no life without it, too. So, hey, just go for it. And he bore the wounds, but joyfully and gracefully. So, that's the book. That's my favorite books in the whole world. Yeah, and it paints the culture in its thoroughness. He says that culture is not about professors. Culture is about artists and architects and sculptors and musicians. This is what changes culture. And he says St. Francis's joy did more to change the culture in the early 13th century than did all the pacts between kings and emperors and popes and bishops, he said. The joy changes culture more than anything else.
I completely agree with that. And two things. One, knowing your very close affinity with Chenu makes a lot of sense. And then in terms of your own cosmic thinking, your own creation thinking, this kind of hole between the microcosm and macrocosm. So I see that now more clearly. And that book actually really had a big influence on me. And I was very enamored of the medieval cosmos.
Yeah.
Harmony, between the human person and the larger world. Do you think Pope Francis's synod that's taking place now, do you think that it's possible even for the Catholic Church to reconceive a new harmony between heaven and earth, a new kind of creation-centered spirituality?
Well, I think his encyclical Laudate Si was an excellent piece of work. One scientist told me it's far and away the best document ever on science and religion ever produced by the Vatican in history. And I'm proud to say that one of my students actually wrote 80% of it, a Irish priest who's a missionary in the Philippines. He went through our master's program, and then he started writing short books on spirituality and ecology. And clearly, Pope Francis read some of them and plucked them up and brought them to Rome and said, write this, which he did. So that's a reality, but can he do it? I'm not holding my breath just because I think that the image I have of the church or other big institutions is a great big ship. And, ships have no brakes. And it takes forever for them to turn around. And meanwhile, the earth is burning and the young are fleeing. And, of course, you have this reality of the scandal of the pedophile priest and the worst scandal, which is the covering up of it by the hierarchy. So, so much credibility has been lost. But I see that really as part of the work of the Spirit, that I think the organization as we know it has to die. And Jesus talked about that. The seed has to die for something new to be born. And, for 2,000 years, Christianity existed in the age of Pisces. And that's very clear. The early Christians were into that. And the whole thing about the fish and the fishermen and the water and the baptism, all that was taken seriously. But now we're in the age of Aquarius, and it is more, a less structured view of life. And so I think all the 2,400 canon laws and all that, I just think the structure is, the way I put it is, we should travel with backpacks on our back and not basilicas. And that's, I just think we have to travel lighter. We have to put spirituality first, not religious structure, and not who's ordained and who's on top and all this. Now, one thing I love about what's going on in the Senate, I really do, is that they're at round tables. And even the Pope is at a round table, and all these bishops are at a round table. Because, you know, I wrote years ago about moving from climbing Jacob's ladder, which is so hierarchical, to dancing Sarah's circle. So a round table means that you're eye to eye, you have to listen, or you're really out of it. And so I think that's the best part of this Senate, is that they're at round tables. Now, whether this can change huge organization like that, we'll have to wait and see. But meanwhile, I think grace is bigger than all human structures and human institutions. And I think a lot is dying, and a lot has to die before, you know, Christianity reinvents itself. And that's what we have to do. And I do think Vatican II was an effort at that reinvention. But it was, of course, what can I say, put in reverse by two popes. But even that was a liberation, if you think of it that way, that the structures were not holding anymore. And it's empowered lay people, I think, to, because there are so few priests around, and the nuns are running out too. So, you know, there has to be a lot of interpretation. But the essence of what the church has in its treasure, the archetypes of the Eucharist and the archetypes of, getting back to it, Jesus taught about compassion and justice and the poor. I mean, that's there.
Right.
In whatever, you know, whatever happens to the structures, that's not what it means anyway. The key, as Chenu always says, is the gospel, returning to the gospels. And that's what Francis tried to do. It's what Dominic tried to do. And we have to try to do it.
Yep.
And to link up with other traditions, with other faith traditions. That ecumenism is not something, what shall you say, on the side. It's not a dessert or something. I have to know how Buddhists teach compassion, and how Jews teach compassion, and how atheists look at compassion. You know, we have to go deeper and then make the connections with whatever tradition we're part of. I see that happening. I really do, especially with young people.
Next week, Ilya and Matthew ask about the viability of institutions, the ancients' view of death, and the allure of resurrection. A special thanks to our team at the Center for Christogenesis. I'm Robert Nicastro. Thanks for listening.